I think probably most of us have had the experience many times in church of going through a book, and when you get to the last verse, you're done. Isn't that pretty much how, I mean, here at Trinity, I know, we've gone through Acts and Revelation. We didn't go through all those books in every detail, Genesis, but you end, and I kind of say myself, because my mind is weak, like, now what all did I learn and how do I put it all together? As Tom just mentioned, how valuable it was to listen through the series on Revelation, not 10 sermons in 10 weeks, but 10 sermons in 3, 4 days, and how you make connections and how you. So that's what we're doing today. Daniel looking at the whole book in one time and making the connections. Now, I've tried, as we've gone through our study, to show you how one chapter is related to another and they're not just independent stories. I've tried to make some of those connections, but now let's do it all together. So, turn to Daniel 1. And we don't have a lot of time and we're not doing any details, okay? We're doing big picture. I entitled my handout here, Putting It All Together. How does it all fit together? What's the main idea or in ideas? What are the major themes? What is God saying through the book? And if you start with chapter one, and I think too, it's a little different than maybe quite different. So then you read the story and you draw some lesson, take some moral out of it. Well, we need to be careful what we eat. That's not what Daniel 1 is about. If I give another example, do you listen carefully to lessons? I mean, these lessons and in church. I mean, last week the sermon was about how you need to, it's 1 Samuel 1 and 2, how you need to receive from God and give back to God. That's not what that story is about. Now, you can make a lesson from it, and that's what we do all the time. That's really common. We don't understand the story in the context. So I want to, I don't want to talk about 1 Samuel, but maybe you'll listen carefully this morning. In Daniel 1, it's not about you need to eat good food. It's about how God has prepared an exilee, right? That's important. Daniel has been removed from his land. The temple is destroyed. He's living in a foreign land, but God's going to work through him. And what's the key ingredient to that? Daniel's loyalty. Now, the way it's expressed is through the diet, right? God had given some very strict laws about the foods you are to eat. And Daniel was faithful to that, and so God's going to work through that and bless him. But the main thing that of chapter one is it's introducing a guy who's going to be used by God. And that, why is that important? And that's two. I can connect that to 1 Samuel. What is 1 Samuel 1 and 2 about? It's about introducing Samuel. Does Samuel have. Samuel's going to anoint the first two kings. Well, who is Samuel? Well, he comes from a godly woman who prayed a godly prayer. So, in any case, that's how. So, Daniel 1, I would call this just the introduction of this Jewish exile who is faithful to God. And to whom, it says here, God reveals truth. Daniel, it says, could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. So, now that you know that about Daniel, you're ready in chapter 2 when the king can't sleep, or he had a dream which kept him from sleeping. He wanted to know what it meant. He tells his wise men, this time, unlike all the other times, I don't want you to just tell me the interpretation. You have to tell me the dream too. They say, what did they say? Very important. They say, no man can do that. There's not a man alive who can tell you what dream you had. You tell us a dream, we'll tell you what it means, but we can't tell you what the dream was. Which is a way of saying, when Daniel says, here's the dream you had, and here's what it meant, who is Daniel? I mean, who? Daniel is one who knows the Lord. Daniel is one through whom the Lord speaks. And it's not just that, but what is the message? What is the dream? The dream is the history of humanity, right? Statue, four parts. We're starting with the first kingdom right where we are now. There's going to be another kingdom. There's going to be another kingdom. There's going to be another kingdom. And then a rock's going to come and destroy the whole statue, all of the kingdoms of man. The rock is God's kingdom to be established on earth. And that's just the beginning, right? The rest of the book is going to build on that, developing that, giving more detail. But it's not going to be easy. That's chapter 3. Chapter 3 is reminding you, oh yeah, we, Jewish people, are still in exile. We don't have sovereign control. We're under this statue. The statue of the four kingdoms now becomes a gold statue that Nebuchadnezzar makes and says, bow down. That's going to be the life of the Jewish people, living under Gentile dominion. And they're going to frequently be called to forsake the true God to worship the gods of the nations. And the question is, what are you going to do? And here we have an example, these three friends who say, even if we die, we won't bow down. And this is the model that all the Jews in exile in their time and thereafter need to say, we're going to be like them, even if we die. Because we know God can deliver us. There's no point in worshiping a God who can't deliver you. But that doesn't mean he will deliver us. I mean, whether he chooses to or not, he's sovereign over that. We will worship him, and we will not bow down to the idols of the nations. And in this case, God does deliver them. And that leads to Nebuchadnezzar's dream. He has another dream, and the interpretation of which is that because Nebuchadnezzar is proud, he's going to be, or let me say it this way. Nebuchadnezzar was given something by God. He was given, he's made a man in the image of God. And like any man, he's given dominion, right? That's the creation mandate in Genesis 1, is God made man to exercise control over his creation for God's glory. But Nebuchadnezzar twisted that around for his own glory, doesn't acknowledge God. It says, look how great I am. So God says, okay, if you're not going to fulfill your mission that I gave you as a man, I'm going to take your manhood, your humanity, away from you. And you'll be a beast. Right? That which distinguishes you from the beast, I will take away. You will become a beast. You'll become the beast that you really are. When Nebuchadnezzar repents, God restores his humanity to him. There's a few connections here with the book as a whole. And one of them is that Nebuchadnezzar, as king of a kingdom, is, to use later terminology in the book, is a horn, right? We talk about the little horn of the fourth kingdom, the little horn of the third kingdom. Nebuchadnezzar is the little horn of the first kingdom. He's the ruler. And what can God do to a little horn of a kingdom? What can God do? He can humble him. He can bring him down. He can, in an instant, destroy, or in this case, humble. And this is too, again, Remember, Nebuchadnezzar was the greatest king of the whole world at the time, and God's greater than that. And that's going to be important. Remember, when you keep reading in the book, and he said, man, this great, awful king, you know, it seems like he's in control. It seems like we are powerless against him. So in a way, he said, God humbled Nebuchadnezzar. God can humble Antiochus Epiphanes or the Antichrist. We have another little horn in chapter 5. Another king, also of Babylon, who exalts himself. And this time he goes a step further. Because he not only says, oh, I'm the greatest, but he, this chapter 5, Belshazzar, he blasphemes God by taking the sacred temple vessels. I mean, it's one thing to take him out of the temple and bring him to Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar had done that. But it's another thing, hey, let's just have a party. And we don't even care that these are the holy objects that only the priests are allowed to touch. Right? I mean, Belshazzar laughs at that. Like, yeah, like every religion has priests, and they're all the same, and none of them really means anything. Right? That's not true. This is the one and true holy God and his vessels, and if you mess with them, you're messing with him. And so God cuts Belshazzar down in a moment. Right? In a night. He's having a party one minute, and before the night's over, he's dead. And not only is he dead, his kingdom is gone. The Babylonian Empire has fallen. So now we're going to move from the head of the statue, Babylon, now to the second part of the statue, the next kingdom. What's the kingdom that replaces it? No, you get it in chapter 6. It's the Medo-Persians. Some things have changed, some things haven't changed. Here's what hasn't changed. The threats against God's people. The Israelites are still living in exile, out of their land, and without sovereignty. And so the nations can say, no, you can't pray to your God. They can make these laws. In this case, it's not the king, but it's his advisors. The threats are going to come from different places. They're going to come in different ways. How are you going to respond to them? Daniel's friends said, we will not bow down to the false gods. Daniel says, I'm not going to stop praying to the true God, even if I die. And God again proves that he can deliver him. This is a very important point that we could miss in Daniel if we don't read it as a book and we don't connect all these points. We don't say, we have Jewish people in exile who are threatened by the Gentiles who must remain true in the midst of this persecution. And this isn't just past because of what's going to happen in the rest of the book. What is chapter 7 through 12 going to predict? More wicked rulers who try to destroy the faith of the people in God. And so the question is going to be, are you going to stand fast or not? And in fact, we know this not only from Daniel, but interject, there will always be a remnant that stands fast. The question is, will you be part of it? And I don't mean that primarily to you as Christians in the church, although there's some application there as well. But chapter 7 is the critical. Maybe you remember I said it was the most important chapter in the book. It's a hinge chapter, a fulcrum. It connects the first half of the book and the second half of the book. It ties back to the first half of the book because it has a vision that's very similar to chapter 2. So it wants to say, wait a second, we have chapter 2 with the four kingdoms. Now we've got chapter 7 with four kingdoms. Chapter 2, it was a statue with four parts. In chapter 7, it's four beasts, which may mean more to you now than it would have without chapter 4. Nebuchadnezzar, a man made like a beast. In fact, all of these anti-God kingdoms are beasts. They're not acting like the men God created them to be. They're not fulfilling God's purpose for them. They're actually acting out against God. So a beast, that's a very fitting term for them. And there's four of them, just like we know before. But there's a little bit extra this time. Because not only do we know that there's four kingdoms, but we learn about, from the fourth kingdom, there's a little horn. A king of the fourth kingdom who's going to be very wicked. Who's going to try to destroy God's people. Darius tried to kill Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar tried to kill Daniel's three friends. This guy is going to try to destroy all of God's people. He's going to blaspheme God like Belshazzar did. He's going to oppress his saints. He's going to try to change the religion and the laws and the calendars of the Jewish faith. And God's going to allow him to have success for 3.5 times or 3.5 years. So it ties back in further in developing what we saw already in chapter 2. It also sets the foundation for the rest of the book. And there's something else I need to get in here too, critical importance. In the vision in Daniel 7 with the four kingdoms, there's not just one individual, the little ruler. We call him the Antichrist once you read the New Testament. But there's also one like a son of man who comes with the clouds of heaven. He's like a man, but he has divine characteristics. And in fact, he is given authority over all the world. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worship this person. We know of him as the Messiah. And later on, actually, in chapter 9, it's going to talk again about the Messiah. Daniel doesn't develop in great length the Messiah like Isaiah did. Isaiah talked a lot about the Messiah. Daniel doesn't, but Daniel just kind of touches up against him here and then again in chapter 9. Let me make this connection. I don't think I've said this at all before. But the Messiah, who is one like a son of man, one like a man, when he rules on earth, right? We're talking about Jesus' future reign on earth. He's going to do what all of those other kings should have done. He's going to rule under the Father, under God, in submission to Him, giving Him the glory, and ruling in perfect righteousness. So I think it's important to see there's a continuity there that I think we can miss if we kind of say, oh, we've got, in fact, in the handout I'll give you here shortly. Did I just say something wrong? He told me he had to leave. I changed some of the wording because I don't want to say the four. I said it this way. I had written it and I had to change it. The fourth kingdom is the final kingdom of man and it's replaced by God's kingdom. Is that true? It's true, but it misses the point that actually we have four kingdoms that are replaced by another man's kingdom. Jesus, the man, is also, of course, fully God, but he's doing what all the other kings failed to do, which is exercise God's rule over the earth in righteousness, in submission to God, giving Him all the glory. I don't know if that makes sense, but
When you're saying that coming back, doesn't He come back? We know in spirit, he comes back as a man the second time.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Jesus. Let me say it this way. Jesus is a man, right? He is God and man in a mystery that we can't understand. But he's once the incarnation occurs when he takes on flesh, he's always that union of God and man. So yes, he's ruling here as a man.
But we won't recognize him as the Son of God.
Yes, we will. He's both. I mean, you can't take any parts away from him. He's always Son of God. He's always man, or son of man. When Jesus always referred to himself as the Son of Man, then he wanted everybody to go back to Daniel 7:13 and say, "Yeah, you are a man. Son of Man means man, but you're the Son of Man who comes riding on the clouds to be the King over the earth."
So there will be no challenge, is what I'm saying, because they know him spiritually that they can't win. There'll be
Can I not answer that? I mean, that's a little bit... the reason why they won't challenge him is because they'll all be dead.
Right.
I mean, well, Jesus is going to come. Jesus is going to come, and they're all going to be attacking and trying to destroy Israel, and he's going to destroy the enemies and establish his kingdom, in which there will be no enemies in his kingdom to start with. But they're going to be bursts of people in their natural, natural bursts, unsaved, and they're going to have to come to faith in Christ, and some of them won't, and at the end of the millennium there will be a rebellion. But that's not Daniel.
That's not a
Revelation.
That, there is going to be not total harmony. Maybe I'm pulling off on the wrong thing.
Yeah, we can talk after.
Okay.
Yeah. I just know I'm going to run out of time here. So, so Daniel 7, just absolutely critical in so many ways, including the fact that it's established we have these four kingdoms. And now in chapter 8, you have to read carefully, pay attention, and make sure you make the right connections. There are two major views of Daniel, the book of Daniel, and the deviation occurs right here. This is where, when we went through the book, I talked to you about how in chapter 8, one view says it's talking about kingdoms 3 and 4, and the correct view is it's talking about kingdoms 2 and 3, and say, well, what is, that doesn't sound like such a big deal. But at the base of those is the question, is Daniel a natural book or a supernatural book? By natural, I mean the scholars who don't believe there's a God who works in the earth have to say there's no predictive prophecy. They have to say all of this book was written in the time of the Maccabees, the Hasmoneans, about 165 BC, and they explain it all the way that way. There's nothing future. It's all past history, but fake prophecy. That's the one view. The other view is that God knows the future, and it's not just talking about the Maccabees. It's talking about the Antichrist in the future, and that view requires that chapter 8 is explaining kingdoms 2 and 3, which makes sense too, because we already know about kingdom 1 in more detail, Nebuchadnezzar, and we already know some about kingdom 4, because in chapter 7 it talked about the little horn of the fourth kingdom, and he's going to oppress the people of God, and, right? So now God gives Daniel a vision to say, hey, let me tell you a little bit more about kingdom 2, that's the Medo-Persians, and kingdom 3, that's the Greeks. So you're going to understand more as history unfolds. You'll be able to say, yep, Daniel is a true prophet of God. This is happening, going down. And not only that, maybe more so, that there's going to be a time of intense persecution during Kingdom 3, during the Greeks, by another little horn. He's going to be so wicked as to cause the temple... He's going to put an abomination, something so abominable in the temple that people just abandon it and leave it desolate. This is coming. Be prepared. This is more that persecution that you've been prepared to expect. But keep trusting the Lord, because He knows it and He controls it. Chapter 9, Daniel... kind of steps back. This one, all these other ones, chapter 7, 9, 10, those three visions are all initiated by God. Daniel's sleeping, and God says, I want you to know this. But in Daniel 9, Daniel's praying himself. Daniel's going to God, and he's saying, God, I was just checking my calendar, and it's about 70 years, and you predicted that the exile was going to last 70 years, so it's about all over, so what's going to happen? He says it a lot more eloquently than that, and his prayer is full of, it's exactly the kind of prayer that the exiles should be praying. What kind of prayer should they be praying? They should be praying, God, we are exiled because of our sin. We have violated your holiness. We have turned away from your laws. We've done which we know to be wicked. So Daniel's praying that prayer, and all the exiles should be praying it along with him, and Daniel's also hope in prayer is, God, deliver us. As we repent from our sin, the 70 years of exile come to an end. Restore us. Restore the kingdom. Take us back to Jerusalem. Establish your temple and your presence there living so that we have this period of righteousness that you've prophesied. And what is the answer? It's a short answer. It's only four verses. Very, very important verses. The end of chapter 9, the answer is this. You know about the 70 years. I want to tell you about the 77s. Those sevens are is a period of 7 years, like a sabbatical cycle, 7 years. So 70 of those sevens is really, you don't have 70 years to wait for the coming of the kingdom. You have 490 years. Except that for it doesn't say 490 years. God could have said 490 years so easily. He doesn't say that. He says there's going to be seven sevens, and the city is going to be built. Then there's going to be 62 sevens after that. That's going to be 483 years. At the end of which, the Messiah, the anointed, is the word for Messiah. The Messiah will be cut off. Which would be a big surprise if you knew nothing about Isaiah. But if you know about Isaiah, then you know that the servant, the Messiah, is going to die. And then there's a gap in there, a period of time, indeterminate. We don't know how long it is before the final seventh, the final week of seven, the 70th seven, at the end of which the evil one is destroyed, the one who causes an abomination of desolation is destroyed, and God establishes everlasting righteousness, his kingdom on earth. Are we okay? I feel like I need to catch my breath. I don't know, is this tying some things together here? There's one more vision left. I know it's three chapters, but it's only one vision. Chapters 10, 11, 12. It's the longest and the most complex vision. And it's one in which God explains to Daniel how chapters 7, 8, 9 go together. Specifically, Daniel has heard about a little horn of the fourth kingdom in chapter 7. He's heard about a little horn of the third kingdom in chapter 8. He's heard in chapter 9 about this abomination of desolation in the end of 70 weeks. Well, now God gives the big sweep of history again. He starts from Daniel's time. Daniel was at the time, it was already the Persian period with Darius. So he says, okay, starting here, there's going to be the Persian kings, then there's going to be the Greek kings, and one of those Greek kings, who we know fulfilled in history is Antiochus Epiphanes, one of those Greek kings is going to be horribly wicked. He's going to destroy the Jewish faith. So didn't you just talk about this? Yes, I did. It's a development of chapter 8, but in greater detail. And then, this is a tricky part. You have to pay attention here, and it's easily missed, and the unbelieving scholars miss it, because it jumps in the middle of, the end of chapter 11, he's describing Antiochus Epiphanes, all the wicked things he does, and then it goes to the next king it wants to talk about, who we know of as the Antichrist, and describes how the Antichrist is going to fight against God's people, but is going to be destroyed. At which time, and it connects, the death of that person, which we know it must be the last king, the fourth kingdom, connects him with the resurrection, the bodily resurrection. So, which is important too, because say, why would Daniel care about this? Right? I mean, Daniel's going to die. I mean, he's already an 80-year-old guy. But God's saying, Daniel, I'm going to raise your body out of the ground. And all the other faithful believers are going to be raised out of the ground to enjoy this wonderful kingdom. So, trust me. Walk in righteousness. Know that I have it all under control. Know that the timetable is established. And withstand, stay loyal to me in the time of greatest persecution. Okay, that's the book.
So Todd, in listening to the revelation that the message is stay loyal in time of great persecution, and many, many cases when you think through Hebrews or him, or you even look at the hardships we sometimes write on our board, it's not, it's going to turn out rosy in this life, and it's not about it. Like, that was the message that you said kind of subtly there, but it was, there is that resurrection coming for you, Daniel, as well. So you will have some blessing here on this earth. Daniel did live some. But there were a whole bunch of contemporaries or other prophets that didn't have the earthly success Daniel saw. They kind of had just the opposite. Those guys are also mentioned in the Revelation.
Yes. That's a very good point. Daniel is a great example of the reality that God is sovereign, and that may not mean your deliverance right now. The three boys who went in the furnace said, God may choose not to save us. That doesn't mean he's not God. Doesn't mean he can't do it. It just means this is the way he's working. And other people weren't delivered.
I have a question.
Yes.
When we talk about being raised from the dust,
yes. I would just say that God raises cremation just accelerates the process of decomposition. So just as God raises the one who naturally decomposed, he'll do it with the one who's been cremated. I personally would not favor cremation. I don't think it's probably the best thing to do, but it doesn't at all hinder God's power to resurrect, and I just said there that God's going to raise believers, but it also says he's going to raise unbelievers, which is to say all those people who persecuted you, Daniel and friends, are going to receive justice. So that's a word of hope. We may think, oh, that's kind of cruel, and no, it's justice. Those people who tried, the ones who tried to kill Daniel by throwing him in a lion's den, got justice because they received themselves what they wanted for someone else who was righteous and didn't deserve it.
Yeah, I hate to be perverse, but just
well, then
because
don't be.
People bring up the thought about raising and what means. I mean, Christians were burned at the stake and
right.
They were eaten by animals and all kinds
right.
of things that happened to bodies of people.
Right.
That does not. God is the creator of the universe, and he
right.
will raise us up from the dust of the earth, even as recreated people. But with, I mean, he's the God that's all powerful. I mean,
right. Right.
So he's not having to take our literal dust that may be spread over the earth.
Right.
He can recreate, so to speak. Try to make that a limitation of God.
Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 15 talks about how it's like a seed planted in the ground. So there's a connection to the original body somehow. Jesus' body that was resurrected was the body in the tomb. It wasn't completely separate. God didn't say, well, I'll just leave that tomb in the grave and give Jesus a new resurrection body without
it. Wasn't that partly because of the faith that we had to see that happened? Otherwise, we wouldn't have made that connection.
I think both. I don't want to give up the other. There's a seed.
There are some people who are burned to a smithereen. I mean, if you were in an intense enough fire, like an incineration or whatever, and your dust is thrown into the water.
9/11.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you're somewhere. I mean, he's going to collect
yeah.
Your molecules still
exist.
Okay, so. I don't really have time, actually.
That clock's fast.
Anyway.
Oh, is that clock fast?
Yeah.
Well, we still have to close, so.
Yeah, it is 10:15.
Let's pray. Father, thank you for this book and how it strengthened the faithful through the centuries. Certainly we know many people in martyrs, Christian martyrs, who have looked to this book for strength, knowing that they can die peacefully because you're in absolute control of it all. And we have the same confidence, and we want our confidence to be stronger. We want to believe more. We want to have a greater trust in you because of what you've revealed to us. So thank you for the lessons that we've gained from this book. In Jesus' name. Amen.